You're listening to Piece by Piece, and I'm Sarah Pauly. I now have on the line with me Miss Joyce Catlett, who is an author, lecturer, and she is the co-author of a new book titled Sex and Love in Intimate Relationships, among the list of books that I read just before the break. She also has collaborated with Dr. Robert Firestone in writing 26 professional articles and 12 books, including The Fantasy Bond, Compassionate Child Rearing, and Voice Therapy. Since 1982, Ms. Catlett has been a national lecturer and workshop facilitator in the areas of child abuse prevention and couple relations. She has co-produced 40 video productions for the Glendon Association in the areas of parent-child relations, suicide, couple relations, and voice therapy. Ms. Catlett developed and trained instructors in the Compassionate Child Rearing Parent Education Program throughout the U.S., Canada, and Costa Rica. And the list goes on and on. Welcome to the show this morning.
Thanks, Sarah.
Such a
Thanks
mouthful.
For the great introduction. It's really my pleasure to be here.
Oh, well, it's my pleasure to have you on. I was joking before the break that this is possibly a heavy topic for some at this time in the morning.
That's why people need a sense of humor when they go into relationships. That's one of the best qualities to look for in a potential partner. It really is.
Let's talk about that then, just to start off, since you mentioned it. In reading through the materials and the book and also having attended a full-day seminar, as I mentioned before the break, explain that, because it feels good when you are ignited by someone else's humor and you get their humor.
Yes, it's not only that, it makes for a very pleasant and fun time, but we've found that people who are non-defensive, and by that I mean they don't overreact to things that you tell them if they happen to be negative or a slight criticism. They don't overreact because they have a way of looking at themselves where they feel truthful and they feel honest, and also they can laugh at things in themselves. And this is so valuable in a relationship. In fact, non-defensiveness, openness, and a sense of humor are among our first qualities that we advise people, if we have any advice to give, to look for in a potential partner, but not only that, but also to develop in yourself. There's so many people that react to criticism by, like, getting angry back, or a lot of people, like, burst into tears, or they sulk, or they give their partner the silent treatment. But what we advise people to do is to just look for the kernel of truth in whatever your partner tells you, and try not to get angry back, because if you get angry back, you're shutting down areas of communication, and that is very bad in a couple relationship. Pretty soon, you and your partner don't have much left to talk about.
So other than being as what I've always thought of, a sign of intelligence, having a good sense of humor, mm-hmm. It also, I think it carries a certain lightheartedness.
Yes, it does. A lightheartedness and an optimism about life, which is also another good quality to look for in a partner. But as I said, the ability to look at yourself and sort of laugh at some of your foibles is such a sign of emotional maturity, I think.
So when one is looking for these qualities, it's probably also important to be mindful that one has these qualities.
Yes. It's, you know, what we tell couples, Lisa Firestone, my colleague, and Dr. Firestone, that to not look for something in your partner that you want to change, but look into yourself and see what is something about yourself that you think you could improve on. Because in this way, if you change something that's sort of undesirable, say your habit of reacting defensively to what your partner says, if you change that, then the whole relationship is going to change for the better.
So, I mean, when you say that, it I think of the most common changes people want to make in themselves, such as perhaps finding a better career, they think they'll be more desirable, or, lightening their hair or, I mean, you know, losing 20 pounds.
Some of those surface things do help. If they help you have a better feeling about yourself or higher sense of self-worth, those are valuable, of course. But we're looking in this book, Sex and Love and Intimate Relationships, we're also looking at things that run a little bit deeper, like the ability to be honest and open with your partner. And by being honest, I don't mean being brutally frank, but really knowing what you feel about yourself, knowing what you want in the relationship, but being able to communicate that in a empathic and compassionate way, you know, without hitting your partner over the head with it, but being honest about yourself and your wants and your needs, and being honest if you have to say something that's slightly critical or negative to your partner, to know how to say it in a really open, nice way without blaming, without being judgmental. And this is an art that people really have to develop. I mean, there's so many courses in communication skills, and this is one area that people can really work on in themselves.
Well, yes, and I think of myself in this instance, that whenever I perhaps am trying to learn a new skill, as you said, this is a perhaps an art and a learned skill, which takes practice. So possibly in the beginning, the scales may fall heavily on the side of maybe, like you said, being a little too honest.
Yes, it's better to really temper your honesty with having a feeling and an understanding that your partner is the same as you, essentially. You both grew up and had different experiences in childhood. Maybe some negative things happened to you or even traumatic things. And your partner is probably likely to have had the same kind of experiences, you know, maybe different, but the same quality of growing up experiences. I mean, every person is damaged to a certain degree in their sexuality as they grow up, for example, or damaged in their ability to be able to even tolerate being loved by a person that they love. So this is really a skill that you have to learn.
Well, then, can we talk, or would you please talk a little bit about that, about how does that happen? Because what I learned from the program that I attended this in 2005, mm-hmm. That was wonderful. It was here at UCI, specifically on the topic of the fear of intimacy, is that it's really not so much our faults. There's not something wrong with us.
No, there's nothing wrong with us. I mean, you know, all children are born, quote, innocent, and the things that happen to us early in life sort of bend us out of shape and twist us away from our natural course of development, our natural destiny, if you will. And some of these events happen in the family. Some of them happen in peer relationships, and a lot of them happen because of society's views of sexuality. I mean, if you look at the media, our society has a way of looking at sexuality, or distorting sexuality, actually, by seeing it in one of two ways, either exploiting it to sell products, as on TV, or to repressing it or thinking of it as something bad or dirty or sinful. So it's no wonder that people grow up thinking of sex sort of as a taboo subject, because it's not talked about in families very much, and really having distorted attitudes towards their own sexuality, towards their own body, towards feeling pessimistic about the future of relationships. So all of these factors really do have an impact on a person's sexuality.
Well, then, Joyce, in chapter 6 of your new book, mm-hmm. Sex and Love and Intimate Relationships, for those of you just tuning in, it's quite a hefty title, and I hope we will discuss a little bit of this, which goes into our childhood experiences. It's the title of the chapter is "The Role of the Fantasy Bond, the Voice Process, and Death." Anxiety in sexual relationships.
That is a full chapter. It really is. It's the main theoretical chapter in there, and I think I can explain a couple of those concepts pretty straightforwardly. The fantasy bond is simply an imagination or an imaginary connection that people form with their partners. And this imaginary connection gradually takes the place of all the friendship, the love, the companionship, the lively sexuality that was present at the beginning of the relationship. And the reason that this happens goes back to childhood. When we're all children, we're all faced with inevitable separation experiences, like, say, the mother goes into the kitchen to warm the baby's bottle, and the baby has no time reference, no time frame, and doesn't know when the mother's coming back, and it just has lots of fears of abandonment, physical hunger, and so they start screaming and protest, and they have a lot of anxiety. But also, the child, every child has the ability, the capacity to imagine an image of the mother in his own mind, that the mother is still there with him. So infants and young children form this imaginary connection in their mind with their mother. And the trick about this is it actually partly relieves their physical hunger. It sort of lessens their anxiety. It really soothes them, if you will. And so this fantasy becomes something that the child, the infant, depends on more and more, especially if the infant's very deprived or rejected. Not only that, but the infant can use just little self-soothing habits like thumb-sucking, rubbing a favorite blanket, to go along with that fantasy of still being connected to the mother. And what this does, since both the behaviors and the fantasy partly relieve the pain and the tension, it gradually makes the infant feel like, oh, well, wait a minute. I'm independent. I really don't need anybody else to feed me. I can feed myself. I can suck my thumb. I can take care of myself. I don't need anybody. I don't need my mother, whose comings and goings are so erratic. So the very deprived child, and in fact all children to a certain degree, start to depend on this fantasy of connection to get them through a painful childhood. Then later on, they grow up and go to college, say, and you sort of drop this pseudo-independent attitude. You sort of drop your defenses a little bit. And that's usually when you meet your first partner and you fall in love. And since you've dropped this defensive attitude a little bit, you're very appealing and attractive. So, say, two people get together. They're falling in love. They have this wonderful relationship. They're excited. And they feel like the grass is greener, if you will. But along with this excitement, there's also some beginning anxieties and fears. And a lot of these anxieties do not even reach the conscious mind of the person. They start to go back to their defenses before they're even aware that they're very anxious. And they go back to feeling like, well, wait a minute. I'm getting too involved too fast. And they pull back. One or the other partner was thought to pull back without even recognizing it. And they go back and they start instituting their defenses. But what they do, couples don't like to know this. They like to think that, well, maybe things are sort of deteriorating because, it's familiarity. That's not the problem. The problem is that they've gotten frightened and they've gone back to their defenses, but they don't want to face it. So they keep on with this fantasy that they're still in love. And that's where the fantasy bond comes in. They have a fantasy of closeness, a fantasy of belonging to each other, a fantasy of being connected. That substitutes for the real love that's gradually diminishing in the relationship. So that is really the core defense. That's what people go back to in their relationships. So many of them, and a lot of times it's right after they've made a commitment, say, to live together, or right after the wedding ceremony, or sometimes they put it off until they have their first child, and then they sort of retreat from each other and they get busy with the baby, if you will.
So this whole concept in our society of commitment phobia and, getting bored with that, or thinking that we're bored with that other individual, or suddenly finding everything that used to like about them.
Yes, you start to find them sort of negative, or you may even be repulsed by them. The very qualities that you selected in your partner, you may come to resent later on. So, but all this is due to the fantasy bond. Now, that's one defense, but the other defense, the secondary defense, is what we call the critical inner voice. And these are simply thoughts that are negative and critical about yourself. Like, for example, oh, well, I'm just not, you know, and you say it to yourself in the second person, almost like you're another person talking to yourself. You might say, oh, look, you're not as attractive as you used to be. Why would he want to make love with you tonight? Or you think negative, cynical thoughts about your partner. Oh, look how cold and rejecting he seems today. Wow, he's really not the man he used to be. Things like that. These negative thoughts and attitudes towards yourself and towards your partner sort of tempt you to go back to that I don't need anybody position, that pseudo-independent position. So what we try to do is to help couples, if they have some anger towards each other, to try to look and see where that's coming from. If they're not thinking things that are exaggerated, the voice tends to exaggerate even some of the weaknesses our partner might have, blows them all out of proportions. And the voice is associated with a tremendous amount of anger and aggression, actually malice. We carry around inside ourselves with this voice, this sort of free-floating malice. And if something upsets us, we start attaching it to, well, our partner's done something wrong. That's why couples come to therapy a lot, blaming their partner. Well, if you can just fix him or her, then everything is going to be fine. But that's really partly based on this critical inner voice that they're thinking.
Well, my guest is Joyce Catlett, who is the co-author of Sex and Love in Intimate Relationships. Joyce, I'm wondering then, this free-floating malice.
Where sort of like free-floating anxiety. You have to pin it on something because you can't stand it much.
Where does this originate? Do you know?
Well, there's many things in childhood that can start this voice operating. The messages that we hear early in childhood, it may be something that was spoken by a parent, like, oh, you're such a klutz, or you're not very smart, or you're so stupid, or you're a troublemaker. But many times it's not even anything that a parent has said or an older sibling. It may just be the way that the parents are interacting with each other. We pick up messages from their relationship that, relationships aren't so great after all. Maybe you should be careful when you get into one. So we imitate the behaviors and the defenses of our parents. Another thing that happens is many times in situations where a parent might be under a lot of stress, they may just totally lose it, you know, like explode in anger. And at those moments, the child really takes on all the angry attitudes that the parent's directing towards him. In other words, he sort of takes on the image of the parent as the parent is at his very worst, not as the way the parent is all the time, because when we're really young, we're very sensitive to painful events. So we take that in the form of this negative thought process that for the rest of our lives, we carry it with us, and when we get stressed out, we direct this thought process towards ourselves. We tell ourselves that we're bad, that we're unlovable, that nobody would want to be with us, or we direct it towards our partner, that they're horrible, and, you know, why did we ever get involved with them? So that's where it comes from. It comes from childhood. It doesn't even have to be parents. It could be an older sibling. It could be your second grade teacher who might have humiliated you and shamed you in front of the class. You take all these messages in and direct them toward yourselves. It's a way of negatively talking to yourself.
And it causes me to remember when I was very young and the fact that now looking back, they weren't such a big deal, these experiences, mm-hmm. perhaps these negative experiences. But as a child, everything is a big deal.
Yes, and especially your parents are bigger than you. So when they get angry, they're very threatening. And some people have said that when they took in these voices, you know, as a negative thought process, they thought that their life was even, you know, in danger because the parent looks so large, 3 or 4 times the size of the kid.
And it just feels so scary.
Yeah, it feels scary when you're young. But as you said, looking back on it, it seems, well, that sure, it was hurtful, but it wasn't that bad. But you can't – what's good is to remember exactly how you felt when you were that small child. Then you get a perspective on – you have some understanding of yourself, like, my gosh, something really happened to me, or several things, that made me limited in my relationship today. So you sort of forgive yourself. You don't get down on yourself so much. You don't feel like you have to be a perfectionist in your relationship and be totally right all the time. It eases that kind of pressure that people put on themselves, either to be the perfect partner or to be the perfect parent. If you have compassion towards yourself about what happened to you as a child, then you're more able to extend that compassion to your partner, too. You'll understand that he's probably gone through some of the same things you did.
So is it helpful then on the flip side to not only kind of remember how you felt and forgive yourself? I mean, it might bring up memories of being rather angry or feeling like the other individual needs to apologize. How do you reconcile that?
I know. Sometimes, you know, when parents, when they're confronted by their adult children, they'll say, oh, yeah, I remember that. I'm so sorry that happened. But so many times these incidents sort of happen on the periphery of the parents' consciousness, and they're not even aware of all they do. So they may not remember, and so they may not feel like apologizing. So this is why we feel that in voice therapy that people should, they have an internalized parent. They should work out this their own issues internally. They don't necessarily have to go back and confront the parent in real life because they're carrying the negative part of the parent in their own heads. And if they can bring those thoughts out in the open and identify them and then direct their behaviors, you know, against the voice, what the voice is telling them to do, that's a much better way than going back and trying to confront a real parent.
Well, then the second part of this very hefty chapter 6 in your book, Sex and Love in Intimate Relationships, well, one of the other components is death anxiety.
Oh, that's right. the child, if you go back to early childhood, now the infant that's formed this imaginary connection with the mother, say during separation experiences or when he's scared, when the child gets to be about, from the age of about 3 to 7, they gradually start to understand about death. First, they understand that their parents aren't always going to be around. Their parents are going to die. But then they sort of go back to that imaginary connection. They use that to soothe themselves or to relieve their anxiety. But finally, they realize, wait a minute, my life is going to be terminable too. I'm not going to live forever. And this really turns their world upside down. Everything that they thought was going to be permanent, they find out is temporary. So kids really go back to their defenses. They go back to the fantasy bond. Some of them may regress in their behaviors. They might start wetting the bed again. They might get angry at their parents for having brought them into this world. All kinds of things happen, but what happens is the fear of death really crystallizes their defenses, the defenses they formed earlier before they even knew about death. So all through a person's life, we're facing two kinds of pain, pain that we have in our interpersonal relationships, and just the pain of the human condition, you know, the war, poverty, illness, old age, and then finally death, which there's a lot of anxiety about.
So then how does that play a role in intimate relationships, fear?
Well, it's interesting. Going back to that couple who first got involved and they're in love and everything, a lot of fears start to come up that I mentioned. First is some fears that they're going to be hurt again like they were when they were kids. They start being afraid to take another chance on really being close to another person. They have new separation anxieties, which they might put on, oh, no, I'm going to be rejected sometime in the future. Then they put the fear of death on the relationship. And what they feel is when people are very close, say, in a sexual experience, and they also are very emotionally close, many times this brings up such a poignant feeling of how precious the other person is to you. And it brings up a fear of potential loss in the future. You know, someday I'm going to lose my partner through death, and then someday I'm not going to be here either. So it's so paradoxical, but a very satisfying, emotionally satisfying sexual experience can bring up these anxieties, but what people will do is they'll maybe start an argument the next day, or they'll be a little bit distant after they've had a very exciting sexual experience. This happens so many times. We have so many cases documented about this. So what people have to do is to be aware that they are feeling some anxiety, and they have to sweat out that anxiety, whether it's about childhood issues, whether it's about a fear of death, which you can't do anything about death, but they have to sweat through those fears and try to remain close. Try to remain in close emotional contact with their partner.
And so this can be hard to do, of course, because it's scary, and you have to be conscientious of yourself.
Yes, you have to really have a lot of self-knowledge. You have to know, you have to gradually learn what are your triggering events. Like, do you feel like really sort of resentful or funny when somebody compliments you? This is just on a very simple level. When somebody says, oh, you look so nice in that dress, and you just feel like dismissing it. Oh, this old thing. That is trying to push positive acknowledgement away. So you have to learn that somebody saying something positive to you makes you feel, like, uncomfortable. And if you take that further, someone who you really admire and love, loving you, makes you feel pain sometimes, makes you feel distress, makes you feel uncomfortable. And you have to learn how to sweat through that discomfort, identify any voices that are coming up and that are telling you negative things about the other person, and just to remain in, as I said, close contact with your partner at that time.
Well, I recall in the workshop that I attended in 2005, the full-day workshop that I mm-hmm. mentioned earlier on the fear of intimacy, mm-hmm. when this topic came up, I felt so free all of a sudden, like, now everything makes sense. Uh-huh. I'm afraid of death. That's it. And then, of course...
And so is everybody else.
And, of course, the fantasy bond and the other issues. Mm-hmm. So many things came into play, and... of course, the title of the book, Sex and Love in Intimate Relationships. I'm wondering, you mentioned stereotypes a little bit earlier,
mm-hmm.
that there's these sexual stereotypes. And I'm wondering, how are sex and love and intimate relationships interconnected, especially in our society, where, as you said, there's stereotypes and they seem to get compartmentalized.
Oh, they
sex
do.
I mean,
there's we learn in our families so many incorrect things about men and women. Like, we learn that, well, all men are just like, they don't have feelings, they don't want to have kids, they don't want to commit to a relationship. I mean, you see that in magazines all over the place. Our women are sort of childish. They cry, they fall apart, so you got to be very careful about what you say to them. Then you have even these, what I would call, positive stereotypes. Oh, look, men really know how to do practical things. They're so much better in math and this and that, and they really know how to take charge, and they're really strong. And women really know how to take care of kids. They know so much better than men, and they know how to communicate. So it's wrong all over the place. There's been... lots of recent gender studies, especially by the social psychologist Janet Hyde, who has found very, very small differences between men and women on most of these areas, especially in the areas of being empathic in their communication. Men and women are equally empathic and equally helpful.
Wait. Okay, yeah. I have to write that down in my diary today. Can you repeat that? I want to make sure I heard you correctly and everyone else did.
Get the 2 months ago, the American Psychologist, the lead article by Janet Hyde, and she's calling this the gender similarities theory.
Okay, I'm writing this down. The gender similarities theory. And so... please go on what you were saying. That
men and women are way more similar than they are different. Of course, in areas of sexuality, men seem to have more sexual drive. They have more sexual fantasies. They tend to be more random than women in their selections. And there are some differences between men and women in those areas. But in all the other areas where these stereotypic attitudes are promoted through popular magazines, all those are downright wrong, and they really make men and women have a lot of animosity towards each other in their relationships, and then they're all so untrue.
So, and some of those are, as you said, empathy.
Empathy, yes. Men and women have about the same kind of empathy. They're able to communicate their empathy. You know what they found? That men and women, when they were reported on self-report questionnaires, the men tended to think that they were less empathic, but they were just acting along with that stereotype. When they put them into actual situations where their behaviors were observable, they were behaviorally as empathic as women. So there you have it.
Well, that's fantastic.
Isn't that interesting?
Well, it makes, I mean, to me, it makes perfect sense.
Well, see, sexual stereotypes, actually, gender stereotypes, are simply an extension of the voice process, of the critical inner voice about other people. You know, if you don't want to feel some self-hatred, sometimes you'll just project it onto somebody else. And men project onto women, women project onto men, and they use these sexual stereotypes to put distance between them.
Well, then, if we can, let's talk a bit about how to achieve healthy sexuality. And I want to read a quote from some of your material that really puts it all in perspective, and maybe this can be the launching point. Healthy sexuality is a natural extension of affection, tenderness, and friendship between two people. That's
like a very simple but all-encompassing kind of definition, isn't it? Yeah, we feel like if partners gradually learn how to accept love and learn how to give love, which, as I said, is a skill that has to be learned, then they're going to be able to, like, during the sexual experience, remain, you know, in close emotional contact with each other. Both of them will be, like, fully present in the moment, and they'll be enjoying just the exchange, the giving and receiving of affection and sexual pleasure. And this quality of their relating is going to contribute a lot to just every other area in their life, their satisfaction in life.
So then, let's say, well, we're looking at this couple that you brought up, this imaginary couple.
This hypothetical couple that have gotten married and they're sort of getting dissatisfied, if you will.
So let's say they work through all of these issues and they're doing great and fabulous. And they are finding that perhaps they're having difficulty keeping their autonomy. Mm-hmm. And maintaining their own identity without the other person feeling slighted or like they're not spending enough time. Because I think what happens, as you mentioned, in the beginning of a relationship, everything's wonderful. You're spending all this time. Mm-hmm. But then slowly you remember that you have friends and
that's
family.
Right, that's right. We find that it's very hard to maintain a really loving relationship if the partners, when they first fall in love, of course they want to spend a lot of time together, but if they give up all their areas of independent interest, the activities they used to like to do, even separate from their partner, if they give up long-term friendships, this can be very detrimental because later on they find out that they've given up huge pieces of their individuality, of their identity, just to form this feeling that they're fused with each other. In fact, a lot of couples that get this way go around saying, talking in we's, oh, we believe this and we do that, just as if they're one unit. So, and one of the...
And that's not healthy.
No. One of the dimensions of a healthy relationship is if you both partners have respect for each other's boundaries, respect for their priorities, for their goals in life. Lisa Firestone and I went to this conference where Ellen Bader talked about this new couple who were newlyweds, and they were spending their honeymoon on the base of Mount Everest. And that was the year that several people had already died on the mountain, 1992, I think it was. Well, he was an expert mountain climber. He had climbed a lot of mountains in Switzerland, and he really wanted to climb Mount Everest. Of course, she was scared and worried, and this was totally against what she wanted. But what she did out of love for him is she said, honey, I'm scared, of course, but go and climb that mountain like you've never climbed a mountain before. And her encouragement and everything, he felt great. He climbed the mountain. He survived. He came down. And they were so much closer than they even were before the honeymoon because she had supported him in what he wanted to do. So you have to support your partner's other interests that are outside of your own self-interest because that's being generous. And generosity and giving is going to make you feel good.
So then sometimes it I know in relationships, one partner may think that they know what's best.
You're talking about the relationship I had with my husband.
Oh, really? Maybe no. Because I can relate.
So, listen, Sarah, we spent so many wasted hours arguing our points. And it was so useless because what we were doing is we were arguing from this defended point of view, like, I know I'm right. It was sort of like that pseudo-independent point of view, like, I don't need anybody. I can take care of myself. And besides that, I'm always right. But what we advise couples to do instead of that, spending hours arguing their points, is to, if you find yourself getting into an escalating argument with your partner, to do what we call unilateral disarmament. That means reach out and touch the other person and say, honey, look, I know this argument is important and everything, but what's more important to me right now is to be close to you. Now, this doesn't mean you have to surrender your point of view and give in and everything. This is just coming from the heart instead of from the head. And what this will do, it'll either melt your partner's heart or it'll at least you'll be able to go to bed that night feeling like you've done the best you can. You'll feel good about yourself. And most of the time, one person, if he reaches out to the other person physically affectionate way, this will stop the argument right there. And you'll look back and you'll laugh at it later. And then when you're both in a better mood, you can discuss the practicalities of whatever it was you were discussing later on. You know, so this is what we advise. Don't hang on to your own point of view or you take a stand on something just at the cost of the closeness in the relationship.
So,
but on the other hand, you don't have to surrender or give in. This is part of learning how to love. It takes practice.
So hopefully this unilateral disarmament mm-hmm. happens before one or both partners have kind of injured.
That's right. Have said something that they regret later on. Yes. Do it in the first stages of the disagreement.
Because otherwise the other person may be so upset mm-hmm. that they're really not willing to be close. They probably want to be as far away as possible.
That's right. You've got to do it in the first few minutes of the argument. You really do.
Well,
and it really works.
Okay. Well, then now you are going to be along with Lisa Firestone, mm-hmm. who's one of your co-authors this evening at a bookstore. Uh-huh. In L.A.
That's right. We're going to be at the Bodhi Tree bookstore. I think it's in West Hollywood, and we're going to be there at 7:30 this evening. And we're going to bring some video clips along with us of couples who are doing this voice therapy techniques to improve their relationships.
Well, and having personally witnessed I don't know if they're the same clips.
No, this is a new one, Sarah. We have just produced it. We have a new video that is called Sex, Love, and Relationships. And we showed it for the first time at the Evolution of Psychotherapy meeting in Anaheim, and it was a big hit. So we brought an excerpt of one of the couples, and we're going to show exactly how they go through the therapy process.
Having seen other clips, it's quite worthwhile because it shows you firsthand, even though it's not yourself, because it's hard to know how this works
mm-hmm.
unless you see an example of it. And then
these are
real instances.
That's right. Uh-huh.
So they're not reenactments.
Oh, no, not at all. It happened was a bringing up the material. Also, we're going to have some, the first part of the film has some people just on the streets in Santa Barbara that we ask them these questions. We ask, what do you think is healthy sexuality? And we have their definitions. Then we ask some other people on the street Well, what do you think is love? How does love express itself in your relationship? So it's very interesting questions and answers from just man on the street.
That brings up one final question that maybe we have, because we have just a couple more minutes. This concept of true love.
Well, you know, millions of people and writers especially love to write about love. But I have one definition here that I got from Eric Fromm, which is very close to Dr. Firestone's definition. But Eric Fromm, in his book, The Art of Loving, said, "There is only one proof for the presence of love, the depth of the relationship, and the aliveness and strength in each person concerned. This is the fruit by which love is recognized." So we just think that in true love, you're just really as concerned with your partner's well-being as you are with your own. And true love isn't just an inner feeling that you have. You really have to have some behaviors that go along with it. You have to have physical affection, small acts of kindness and generosity, just a joy in watching your partner flourish and develop personally. There's so many components to it.
Well, thank you just so much. I know we could sit here for much longer.
Sarah, there's one other thing I'd like to mention.
Please.
A new website that Dr. Firestone's wife, Tamsin Firestone, has. It's called psychalive.com. It's P-S-Y-C-H. A-L-I-V-E, and it just was redesigned, and it's a beautiful website, and it's for self-help. It's got a section on relationships, on sexuality, and a section on child-rearing, too, and it's really good. It has a journaling, secure journaling site also.
And, of course, folks may want to check out the new book that we've been talking about this morning.
Yes, you can get it on our website, or you can get it at Amazon.com, of course, but you can get it on our website at www.glendon.org.
And the title of the book is, of course, Sex and Love in Intimate Relationships. And my guest this morning has been Joyce Catlett, one of the co-authors, who is also going to be at the Bodhi Tree Bookstore. That's B-O-D-H-I, Tree Bookstore. That's three words.
That's right.
At 7:30 this evening, and I believe it's on Melrose.
Yes, it is.
Okay, and that's in Hollywood, in L.A. So, you know, brave the traffic. It's right. Well worth it. I highly recommend it, and thank you once again.
Oh, Sarah, thanks so much. It's really been nice talking to you.
Likewise.